Hey friends, software is everywhere, putting us devs on the front lines of innovation, improving people's lives, shipping new and better features, all while moving faster than ever before, which is where our friends at Raygun can help. Their powerful error and performance monitoring tools make it easy to get all the diagnostics you care about for your team's web and mobile apps. When there's an issue, it shows you exactly what's going on, who's being impacted, and how to fix the root cause, down to the specific line of code. See how your users are experiencing your website or app in real time and ship better code faster with confidence, knowing that Raygun will alert you to any new issues or regressions. Start a free 14-day trial of Raygun today and try it for yourself. It only takes a few lines of code, and their simple usage-based plans start at $4 a month, a small price to pay to get your team and users to love you. Visit Raygun.com. Try it out. Thank me later. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm chatting with Taylor Poindexter. She's a software engineering manager at Spotify. How are you?
Doing quite well, Scott. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. So you went to work at Spotify during the pandemic. What was it like taking a job change in the middle of a global panini?
I'm not going to lie. It was a little bit weird, especially because right before that, I'd come off an 8-month sabbatical. So getting back into the swing of things in general, but then also having to get used to networking and getting to know folks virtually was a bit of a challenge. But we got through it and I'm excited I made the change.
Had you worked remotely before?
Only on like Fridays, you know, the one-off days that some companies would offer, but nothing fully remote.
Mm-hmm. And this is fully remote, right? Are you reporting into Europe or where does Spotify roll up into?
So Spotify is based out of Europe in Stockholm, to be specific. Sorry, I forgot for a second.
Yeah, I've been to their office. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. But a lot of people on my team are in New York, including my manager. And so I make trips up to New York, but for the most part, I work out of my home in the DMV area.
Very cool. So you have how many people working for you now as a software engineering manager?
8 people.
Have you met them all?
Yes, because funny enough, the guy that I just hired this past month, him and I used to work together. So even though I haven't technically met him in person as part of this team, I met him obviously in the past.
Is that how you thought your foray into management would be? Like, did you think you'd be sitting in a room with a whiteboard and talking to people in person, or did you imagine it all over video calls?
That's a funny question. Definitely did not imagine it being fully remote. I definitely foresaw a whiteboard surrounded by people daily.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on like those whiteboards that are like floor to ceiling whiteboards. I love it when like you can't tell if is it a wall or is it a whiteboard. So I thought software engineering was going to be like a ton of like vibing in front of a whiteboard with like unlimited pizza.
They love to give us pizza, don't they?
Well, this is not the future that they promised us, is it?
It surely is not. I will admit too, like at my last condo, I had a whiteboard and I would vibe in there all the time, even if I was by myself. But when I moved, I let the whiteboard go and that may have been a mistake.
You had an apartment, a condo, a house with a whiteboard in it. That is a beautiful flex for an engineer right there.
Right. It was wonderful. I kept it super crisp, super clean all the time. People were very impressed anytime they came over.
You know, and then the trick is to figure out how to hook that up so you can, I'm just going to share my screen and you're actually sharing the wall somehow. You got to figure out how to project the wall directly into Teams or into Zoom.
Oh, yeah. I'd just be like with my expo marker showing the team real live exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. I miss that a little bit.
So you've been in tech for a while, but is this your first lead position as an engineering manager?
So it's kind of funny because I started my career in consulting. And for anybody that has been in consulting, you know, it's the wild, wild west. So I was managing people probably before I should have been, more so informally. And then once I got my back-end engineer role, I ended up being team lead. And so again, I was leading folks, but they weren't necessarily reporting directly to me. This is where I'm fully responsible for all the one-on-ones, the promotions, and everything falls on me.
Yeah, so that's really interesting because I think that when folks are thinking about moving into an engineering manager position, every company is different. For some, it means technical leadership. For some, it means HR, you know, direct reports type of leadership. And it sounds like for you, it's all of those things?
Yeah, definitely all of those things. I do the hiring. I do the promotions through and through. I just try to take care of the engineers and give them whatever they need.
I found that very intimidating when I didn't sign up for the HR part. I signed up for the let's talk in front of a whiteboard part.
I definitely agree. And it's funny enough for me, this is the first time I'm also joining a team, like a technical team, and I wasn't an engineer on the team before being in a leadership role. So I will admit that is kind of intimidating for me, at least. I got the management stuff down for the most part, but then having to learn the technical stuff on the fly as well.
I've been having a lot of engineering managers on the show over the last couple of months. It's kind of like we're in an engineering, like I have themes on the show, and you know, there was a old school retro tech theme for a while, and now it's kind of been exploring people getting into engineering management theme. And every single one of them has said that they thought or they felt that they would need to be the smartest on the team, and they immediately realized that their job is not to be the smartest on the team. Like your initial reaction is like, oh, I'm senior, I should be the lead. But then you realize that there's so many smart people, you'll never be the smartest in the room. What is it like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So luckily I had that realization that I don't need to be the smartest person on the team at my last job. I feel like I went through like a whole cycle when I first started being an engineer. I was like, you know, heavy imposter syndrome, like kind of a tough manager. And then I got my confidence. And so now I'm at the point where I'm like, you know what? I will probably never be the smartest person in the room again, but I'm completely okay with that. As long as I'm giving the smartest people in the room exactly what they need to prosper, then I'm doing my job right. And I'm okay with that.
So that's a really good way to put it. So your job is to make sure that they can prosper. So you're blocking and tackling, keeping, giving them air cover, keeping other managers off their back.
Oh, yeah.
How much is pair programming a part of what you all do, even though you're remote? How often are you like talking to each other about problems?
That's a good question. So we actually just started mobbing sessions. Actually, as you and I speak, my team is in a mobbing session right now. And so every Wednesday for, I think, about 2 to 2.5 hours, they have an open block. And if somebody has a problem that they'd like to pair on, or maybe honestly in the remote world, sometimes it can be hard to get that energy going when you're just sitting by yourself in a room. And so they just can tag each other. They'll get in the conference room virtually, obviously, and then go into breakout rooms and pair program together. And I think that has been a great way to not only have them learn from one another, but then honestly push past issues that may have taken them many more days than it took before.
Now, in the past on the show, I've had Woody Zuhl, the inventor or the discoverer of mob programming, on the show. So folks can check out that episode on mob programming or group programming. Is that something that's unique to your team, or is that a Spotifyism?
So as far as I know, it's unique to my team, but I know that there are other teams that also do mobbing sessions, but I'm just not sure of their cadence.
Maybe you could explain what that means, what mob programming is versus pair programming.
Usually pair program is just two folks, and obviously you don't want to overwhelm the person that's leading, but typically what my team does, we have a defined problem we're trying to tackle. They'll get in a virtual room together and kind of just throw ideas off of the wall and work together, almost like pair programming, but with more people. That's how I'd simply describe it.
When building, though, diverse teams, both in all aspects of identity, but also aspects of personality, I have heard that with both remote and then group sessions, those that are shy or those who are from non-Western cultures may not feel like they're heard. How do you work through those challenges?
That's a good question. And honestly, it goes back to something that I feel like I learned in the last couple of months, is that every engineer needs something different. And so usually what I do is, like, first of all, remind myself to, if I see somebody who may not be comfortable speaking up, to make room for them, but then also to remind the other leaders in the room and the other engineers, like, hey, if you see this person and they're like, you know, making a face, you can usually tell if somebody wants to say something, even if they're not saying something, making sure that we're all doing our part to make that space. And also talking to the person directly to see if there are other things that I can do to make space for them. Some people prefer to provide feedback written instead of verbally. And so I know that, you know, you can't accommodate every single thing, but where I can, I help them out in that way.
So what do you say to those who might say, well, they should just interrupt more? They should just kind of like stiffen their back and just learn to interrupt. How would you tell that to? Would you tell that to a young person or someone from another culture?
No, absolutely not. You know, we're all different, and that's kind of like the beauty of it. So I know while it can be easy for certain people to say that you should do this or you should do that, if that's not the way that you're wired, that's okay. I'm pretty sure that even if somebody isn't, you know, super comfortable speaking up, they probably bring other valuable things to the team. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. So I believe in providing space and, you know, being empathetic to folks, especially because some people may just be shy, or you never know what a person is going through personally. So a little empathy goes a long way, especially with team building.
I like that you acknowledge that otherwise you wouldn't be here. I think sometimes people at work need to be told that, hey, you're here. Like, you're getting a paycheck and we appreciate you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
Right.
And that's really powerful stuff.
Heck yeah, I completely agree. And I think that, like, especially in the culture that we live in, like, a lot of times you always feel like, you know, you need to be doing more, you need to be pushing for it. But especially on some teams, like, it's hard to get a job offer. You know, so the person got the freaking job offer and you've been here and you're doing the work. Like, this team wouldn't be able to be what it is without you. So I think reminding my team of that is also something that I try to do, like, how grateful I am of everything that they do, because they really don't have to do it, honestly.
I'm going to use that. This team would not be the same without you. Like, it's both, like, literal, like, in a kind of a jokey way. Like, yeah, it would be different. You wouldn't be here. Yeah. But it's also really true, because the things that we did, we would be doing them differently if you, whoever you are, wasn't on the team. That's really deep. I like that.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Historically, you've talked about imposter syndrome. I've seen interviews with you a couple of years ago about imposter syndrome. I think we're actually kind of similar in that we go back and forth between, I am so good, I should get a raise, and why do they let me come to work every week? And it's just an oscillation back and forth. Do you feel that way?
100%. I was actually just going through this last week as I was on top of the world, like, absolutely feeling super confident about myself. And then I sat down and wrote my, or started to write my promotion packet. And I was just like, yeah, you don't deserve it, girl. And I started getting down on myself and the cycle continued. But now I'm starting to feel back on top of the world.
Historically, people say, and psychologists say, that is a good sign. Do you believe that imposter syndrome is just a way of your brain pushing you forward? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Sometimes, even though I wish it wasn't a thing, but then I'm all about balance. So I do think that it could be a good thing to make sure I'm not some narcissistic jerk, but then also the fact that I'm able to also get out of it and have confidence in myself, maybe it is a good ebb and flow, even if it's a bit painful.
Mm-hmm. Have mentors helped you work through that? I know that you have very strong feelings about mentors and the mentorship relationship.
Honestly, the main way that they've helped me work through it is simply believing in me a lot of times. And it can seem like such a small thing, but obviously I've asked them to be my mentor because I respect them and value their opinions and, you know, think they're just absolutely amazing. So to have somebody that I feel that way about tell me that they think I'm amazing and, like, really support me and be willing to put their necks on the line to push my career forward, it's often like a gut check to me, like, wow, if, like, Nivea thinks I'm amazing, like, maybe I am amazing. And then, you know, it kind of helps boost my confidence a bit and keep me going.
Yeah. What does the mentor relationship mean for you? Are they a hype person? Are they a strategist? Like, there's a spectrum in the mentorship and sponsorship world.
It kind of varies person to person. Definitely a hype person. I feel like that helps a lot too. But then also strategy, because, like, there are times where I think that I know the best way to go. And I'm not saying that a mentor should give me the direct answers. But if they're at where I would like to be at, you know, they can help me come up with a couple of different avenues to get there, which is nice. And sometimes it's just like, just to kind of like, listen, I don't want to call them like a therapist, but it's kind of just like, I had this experience, I'm struggling with it. And for them to simply say, I don't have the answers, girl, but I've been there too. And it's rough and you'll make it through it. And I'm here to, you know, love on you and support you in any way that I can. That support system really means a lot to me.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me for asking, but it sounds like a number of your mentors are women, because I'm getting a nurturing vibe in the way you're describing that. Was that on purpose?
Yeah, that's funny, because I guess it's like a split. Between, I have several Black women I rely on, but then I also have a lot of white men. So it's a blend.
And are they all nurturing in the same ways? Because I found early on when I was learning how to mentor that I was doing it wrong. And I ended up bringing big dad energy. And instead of a mentorship relationship, it was just a weekly lecture from me. And that's not what they needed. So I stopped doing that.
Oh, man, that's hilarious. No, they are not always as nurturing. The women are definitely more nurturing. My guy friends are a bit more tough love at times, but I'll be honest, sometimes I need that too. So I think, again, the balance keeps me in line.
Yeah. I have a tendency to be like, how are we going to fix this? And like, no, I don't want to fix it. I just want to complain for a while. And the guys are like, I don't really have the time to listen to you complain. Can we just call me when you want to fix it? You know?
Let me know when we're in the solutioning phase.
Yeah. Because I'm ready. Like, who are we going to go fight? Yeah. Right. That's my solution. My wife comes home from the hospital and she's like, these people are so mean. I'm like, okay, let's go. Like, if I'm ready, let's roll, you know, get my shoes.
I'm ready, babe.
Yeah, exactly. Who are we taking out today? And it's like, I want to be supportive. She's like, that's not what we're doing right now. We're just, she says, my wife says, cry with the crying.
Ooh, cry with the crying. I like that.
Cry with the crying. It's apparently as a Bob Wynn phrase, but it's basically just listen and say, yes, that must be hard. And that's awful. And then cry with them. And then we go and we roll. And then we take care of business.
It's a process.
Yeah. This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Partner Hero. Partner Hero provides customer service outsourcing that's built for the needs of scaling and high-growth startups. They offer flexible terms, fast onboarding, and the ability to scale teams quickly, which is great for fast-growing businesses. Now, in the past, outsourcing has had a bad reputation for being exploitative or somewhat, you know, low quality. But Partner Hero's values-based approach really raises the bar. They pay above-market salaries, they have a focus on quality and performance, and unlike most business process outsourcing companies, their management team includes individuals from the startup world. So they're more than just a service provider. They're a thought partner for the startups that they serve. They've got flexible terms. They've got offices around the world. So they have truly global coverage, including onshore, nearshore, and offshore options. Now, outsourcing has long been available to many big enterprises, but Partner Hero is challenging businesses as usual with short, flexible contracts and fast ramp-up times. If you're ready to bring in outside customer support help for your startup that feels like it's a part of your existing team, check out Partner Hero. Head on over to partnerhero.com/Hansel Minutes to book a free consultation with their solutions team. Mention that you heard about Partner Hero from Hansel Minutes and they'll waive the setup fee. That's partnerhero.com/Hansel Minutes. Were you always an engineer? Were you thinking when you were 12, like, I'm going to take apart the toaster and build a better toaster? Or did you think about getting into a different career?
Honestly, so if you could imagine it, little Taylor, she grew up in a small country town with like a lot of land. She was always running through the forest, playing with animals, picking up snakes and all that stuff. So I always thought I wanted to be a veterinarian. Yeah.
That is a very farm girl kind of thing. I know a number of farm, my niece grew up on a farm. First thing, oh, I love animals. I'm going to be a vet.
It's a natural line of job security. You know, it's like, love the animals. Let's go do it. But then I feel like I got a little bit older and I don't know what made me change. Actually, you know, what's funny. A lot of teachers and stuff would tell me that I would be like a great leader. Like, you should be a leader. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. So then I thought I wanted to be like a businesswoman. Also thought I wanted to be like just a regular human doctor.
Regular human doctor.
No animals just go around.
When you expressed it, seemed so much less interesting than dealing with the babies, the bunnies and stuff. And I was like, oh, I guess I could treat humans.
Ah, you know, they kind of suck sometimes, but I guess I'll just deal with the humans. Yeah. But then my third year, like my cousin told me that I should try software engineering. And so I tried the class, I sucked at it, but I liked the challenge and decided just to change my major third year and stick it through.
I have recently been on TikTok and two of my duets, that's when you reply to someone who's already on TikTok and you give a video to their video, have been trying to support some people who have been in tears in software engineering. And I've been watching people kind of like collapse somewhere around junior year. You know, you hit algorithms or you hit compiler class. I felt the same way. For me, it was calculus and I just almost broke. Did you ever feel like you weren't going to pull it off?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially because I declared so late. A lot of my classes didn't transfer because I think I was on the medical path at that time. Mm-hmm. So certain things like transferred over and certain things didn't. Discrete math really kicked my butt. Yeah. And I was just like, can I do this? I'm cramming all these classes in. Even last week, I took my little cousin out to lunch. And I can't remember why he asked me, but he asked like what my grade was, my lowest grade was in software engineering the entire time. And I think I said like 27. He was like, 27? I was like, keep in mind, I was an A student overall before I decided to be an engineer.
I was an A student. That hurts. I feel that. Like my first C was like applied calculus. And even now, I also explain this to my kids. I worked for that C. Like it wasn't just a C. That was a blood, sweat, and tears 79. And it hurt. That hurt. The whole thing hurt.
Everything hurt. Yeah. I want to cry.
Now, I noticed that your degree is I don't know if this matters or not, but it says a Bachelor of Applied Science, but it's in computer science. Is that just a thing that the University of Virginia does, or does the applied part matter for you?
At first, I was kind of, what kind of emotions did College Taylor have? I was kind of upset because I declared so late, like I would have had to stay longer if I went completely through the engineering school. Mm-hmm. Like I think I would have had to extend it by a year and a half. So they had that degree. I think that was the first year they offered it. So I wasn't technically in the E school, but I still got the CS degree. Hmm. Yeah.
That's cool. The reason I ask is that when I was starting school, I had to decide between computer science, which I don't have a degree in, and software engineering, which I do have a degree in, which is the application of computer science. And the philosophy, at least that the professor told me, I don't know if they lied 30 years ago, but was there's this science of computing and, you know, like the math behind it and the lambda calculus and compilers. And then there's unit testing and running a team and scrums and extreme programming and pair programming. And then the application of computer science is software engineering. So when I saw that your degree was in applied science, I felt some kind of kinship, like, okay, it's not the theory, it's the doing. And you seem like a doer.
I am a doer. And I will say they did focus more on the applied at the time. So I also, after taking calculus, did not want to take any more of the theoretical deep dives. So hedge my bets there too.
Yeah, that is the move. So you've been doing this for a while. Now you're an engineering manager. Have you ever felt like you were going to burn out? Have you ever had that, like, this is it, I can't do this anymore?
Honestly, mid-quarantine, because I was working at a startup, I just like reached my limit. And that's what ended up making me take the sabbatical and kind of reassess like what brings me joy. Because like while the startup was cool, I realized I was not getting a lot of joy, especially remotely where we don't get those pizza parties and such things that startups give you all the time. That was the one time I thought I was going to burn out.
And how did you solve it? Did you walk away? Did you sleep your way through it?
Yeah, I just walked away. I ended up quitting my job. I didn't have another job lined up. But luckily during quarantine, I'd also invested in a lot of stocks, shout out to Tesla at the time. And so I had extra money to be able to not have a job for 8 months.
Wow. That's a very cool privilege to have. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. And so in the first half of that, I really like sat with myself after recharging a bit and thought about like, okay, what brings you joy about your job? And I realized that while software engineering was cool, if I'm being completely honest, I realized sometimes I was doing it to prove to other people that I could do it, where what actually brought me joy was giving people a safe space to thrive and grow their careers. And so, especially because I knew what it was like not to have that in a manager. And so at the time, I didn't think it was anything special. But then people that have worked under my leadership have told me like how much that meant to them. And so being able to provide that every day sounded cool. So I was like, let's give it a whirl.
You know, people tease me because of the analogies that I use. And they're like, man, I don't know if that analogy worked. And these are weird analogies. So I'm the person who gives weird analogies. And one of the analogies that always works for me is when you're a little kid and you're running downhill and you cannot believe how fast that you're running and you think you're going to take off and you put your arms out and you're going to fly. But then you look down and you see your feet and then suddenly you're running and you think about your feet. And you trip, but the only reason you tripped is that you looked at your feet. It makes me think about like intentionality and being present versus just letting things happen. And I like how intentional that you are, that you stopped for a second. You thought about what it is I want to do, what direction I want to run, as opposed to just running as fast. And then you needed that time to go and decide, why am I doing this? Why am I running? And who am I doing it for?
Heck yeah. Because like if life has taught me one thing is that like, even if you're not being intentional, life is going to drag you places. And so you may end up somewhere that you don't want to be. So it's like, all right, sometimes just slow the heck down, figure out where it is you want to go and then attack.
Life is going to drag you places. I have not heard a phrase like that. That is really true though. Because if you accept the defaults, you're going to just hit next finish. And the next thing you know, you're going to be somewhere that you don't want to be, but you got to click custom.
Yep.
And go through all the options and figure out what's next for you.
Heck yeah. And that's like kind of ties into like what I've been really trying to do since I started working again is I have a hard time saying no a lot of times. And so like also being intentional about what I say yes to and making sure I'm not letting life drag me certain places or I'm stretching myself so thin on the things that don't really pour into me that I don't have time to pour or the energy to pour into things that do pour into me and pour into the people that I care most about.
It is so hard to say no to people.
Yeah.
It was a podcast, but the face that you just made was like the exact face that I made too. It was just like, I want to help you, but also why? But then you have to start thinking about humans, and humans are so squishy, and why am I doing this? And why do you want me to do this? And do you just want free labor? And you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's funny because I was thinking about how spread thin I was earlier today. And then I thought about your Twitter following, and I was like, goodness gracious, he has like over 300,000 followers. So like the number of people that hit me up randomly for a request, I'm pretty sure I can't imagine how many you get. So it was also another reminder to me to like, keep saying no.
But here's the thing though, you keep saying no, but you also have to watch for that one or two moments where luck can happen and where you can be someone's luck. So someone is prepared and an opportunity presents itself, and luck is opportunity plus being prepared. I can create opportunity. You can create opportunity. We can do that by forwarding a resume, by taking 5 minutes, by retweeting or by, you know, referring someone to a job at Spotify, and then you end up working with them.
Yeah.
You've created luck. Now they never need to know that you've created it, but it's a challenge because you don't want to do it indiscriminately, you know?
Exactly. And that's what I'm trying to figure out now. Cause like, I will say the reason why I'm like leaning more into no is that I feel like I've poured a lot of energy into ask people are thrown my way that I felt like they didn't really carry for it. So I feel like I spent my energy almost for nothing. But then I know there are people out there that are genuinely prepared and will carry it for it and make it worth the while. Not even like for myself, but even just for them, which would make it worthwhile to me.
Yeah, that's the hard part. You give someone an opportunity, you like introduce them to someone, and then they don't show up.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, you just burn me.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to be a transactional networker, but also if I introduce you to someone, you should probably show up and you should probably make me look good. And they should be gushing. Oh my goodness, Taylor was so great. Thank you so much for introducing me. Well, thank you for bringing it, right?
Exactly. So I'm still navigating that part. It's tough.
Yeah, that is extremely challenging. So where do you think your career is going to go from now? Like you can be a manager of managers, but then wouldn't that make you farther away from the code?
Ooh, it would. But I think I'm okay with that. Like right now, I'm trying to stay technical enough to be dangerous and make technical decisions. But ideally, I want to be like a director of engineering. And so moving up the ranks there and continuing that path forward, like I'm okay being away from the code. Like I still run Black Code Collective. I'll still attend tech sessions, and Spotify has a lot of good courses for me to take whenever I want, but I'm okay being further away from the code.
How many years do you think someone should be an engineer before they start thinking about what it means to be an engineering manager, which I think we agree is different than being like, quote unquote, a lead engineer?
Yeah. That's kind of hard too, because I feel like even just different titles and different years at different companies can mean different things. Mm-hmm. Like I know people that have technically only been in the industry for maybe 4 or 5 years, but they are stellar engineers, even more than people that have been here for a decade or more. And so the main thing I would really want to emphasize before someone pivots into engineering management, to have a solid like understanding of the core foundational concepts and being able to code at least on like a mid to senior level engineer before pivoting. So that way they can contribute to the conversations their teams are having when they're engineering manager and ask the right questions.
When moving into the engineering management world, it feels to me like it's more about architecture. So then we start thinking about the role of what an architect is, you know, putting the boxes and lines together. Do you find yourself in those kind of roles?
The funny thing is that like I'm in those conversations more, but even still, like there are like staff engineers there who honestly know more than me. So again, I'm okay with that and just making sure I'm asking the right questions and have like a solid architecture foundation.
I had Sarah Cooper on the show a while back, and folks should check it out. She wrote a really great book called How to Appear Smart in Meetings. And sometimes when I'm in those meetings with like incredibly smart people or big engineering managers, I'll just say, can you go back a slide? And then I'll go, then you say, yeah, I thought so. You leave it wide open. Or you say, you know, but will it scale?
Exactly.
She worked on Gmail at Google, and she said that was like her main trick to keep up on those things.
That's perfect.
You can use that. She's great.
Love it.
Yeah. So you've done automation engineering, you've done test engineering, you've done backend engineering, and now you're doing software engineering manager. And the next big move is going to be directing an engineering department. Do you feel like culture and comfort is what you're going to bring most to that? Is that your leadership style?
Yeah, 100%. Servant leadership. I used to hate that term, but I feel like it describes my type of leadership perfectly.
Why did you hate that term?
I don't know. It just felt like another one of those buzzwords. Like sometimes if a word is too buzzy, I just try not to use it. But I just submitted and admitted that's exactly what my leadership is, and I'm okay with that.
What does that mean to you? Maybe explain servant leadership. It is a bit of a buzzword, and servant is a loaded and complicated word. But it does describe exactly, though, what a leader should do.
Yeah. So like when I was growing up, I used to think of a leader that as someone who told everybody what to do. It's kind of like, you know, directing the ship at all time. The people that they were leading didn't really have much of a say. But now as a servant leader, I realize that I'm very fortunate to have the people that work for me working for me. And so being, again, able to give them whatever they need and remembering that it's bigger than me. It's about the cause. It's about what we're trying to accomplish together and taking the ego out of it as a leader.
Yeah. And other themes that matter in servant leadership that I feel strongly about are things like empathy and community building. And I've also liked the term steward more than servant. You know, servant, of course, applies artificial hierarchies and stuff like that. But if you're like, you know, a shepherd or a steward, then you know that you care. Well, a servant is a little too Downton Abbey.
I like that. Steward leadership.
Yeah, we should make that a thing now.
Yeah, let's just start today.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today, Taylor Poindexter.
Likewise. Thank you for having me, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.